Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
Welcome to the latest episode of aerospace radio station, Extended.
It became home to the Embassy Air Tattoo and then what became known as the International Air Tattoo. Many airmen that came to Greenham Common said it was the best time in their life. Many of them married local women. Some of them still have family and grandchildren that are being born today here as a result of their time at Greenham. So there is an ongoing personal connection of friendship and family between West Berkshire and the Americans who were airmen at Greenham Common.
Welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello, I'm Peter Johnson, and thank you for joining us today. As mentioned in our last episode, we're starting a new series of airport and airfield episodes, telling all of their stories and hearing about their history. Before we get started, though, I want to mention a name that came up when talking to Stephen Bridgewater, longtime supporter and listener Andrew Kitney. Andrew's followed my journey from the 200 airplane geeks across the pond segments right through the extended journey. That's over 13 years of podcast following. During that time, he's reached out many, many times to us. He's followed everything on social media and supported us all through this journey. He's even invited me to events at places like Duxford. So a big shout out to Andrew. Thank you for all your support. If you'd like to support the programme, we welcome listener donations. If you want to make a regular or a one-off donation, and please again, only if you can afford to do this, then see the donate button on our website. If you don't want to donate but want to show us your appreciation, please leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or buy your Amazon shopping through the link on our website. Okay, back to the show. Today, we start the series with RAF Greenham Common, and I'm delighted to welcome Jonathan Sayers. Jonathan is a local historian and author of the book In Defence of Freedom, A History of RAF Greenham Common. Jonathan, welcome to Extended.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to talk about RAF Greenham Common. But first, I want to find out a little bit more about you, about your background and how you came about to have this interest in aviation and Greenham Common.
Well, I'm from Berkshire. Greenham Common is in Berkshire. And I grew up in the 1980s and especially in the first half of the 1980s, Greenham was never out of the news, really. Not necessarily for good reasons, but because we were in the Cold War. So I'm the last generation of people that grew up in the Cold War. So it was a frightening time, and it was very much on my mind as I grew up because of where we lived in Berkshire. So the Cold War wasn't some distant thing in some other country. It was very much where we stood. And so, I mean, that had a big impact on me, very big impact on me, I have to say. As you know, East-West relations are again as we speak right now.
Yeah, maybe we're in a new Cold War, aren't we?
Yeah. So that anxiety and that kind of atmosphere was very much part of the time I grew up in. Of course, you know,
right.
that reduced, you know, with Gorbachev coming to power and Glasnost and the end of the Cold War And then we grew up in a bit of a different way once that had subsided. And I did a degree in international relations because I was very interested in international politics. So I've got a BA in international relations.
Okay, right.
And very much interested in international politics as well as aviation. And so Greenham Common sort of brought both those things together, really. It was part of the Cold War, but it was also... there was an aviation story there right on my doorstep.
Yeah.
So that's what got me interested. And 30 years ago, in fact, this year was when Greenham Common closed permanently. So then it just was at risk of failing into obscurity completely. And I thought, we can't let this happen, really. We can't let this sort of great landmark of history just fade into nothingness, really. So that's why I took up the baton, really, and just got really interested in it and tried to preserve its history.
Wow. Okay. Wow, that's fascinating. So you mentioned roughly where the airfield is. Tell us a little bit about its location, the local geography, where it's near, and that sort of thing. Just in the context of some of our listeners won't understand where Newbury is in the UK.
Sure. Well, Greenham Common is about 52 miles west of London. If you had a map of Britain, it would be in the lower south part, almost sort of dead centre, really, of the south of England. So it's about 2 miles south of the town of Newbury. So it was quite close to a town, which is unusual for an airfield. They're not normally that close to towns. So that's where it sits, really.
And how did the airfield come about? I think from some of the work you've done, I read that there, before the airfield even existed, pre-World War II even, there were some early flights into the area?
Yes, there were. If you go back even further in history, I mean, it was used as a camp for soldiers back in the Jacobite Rebellion, in fact. So it had a sort of military use way, way back, albeit transiently. But back in 1930, when the RAF was still operated biplanes, some biplanes of the RAF landed there briefly on an exercise in 1930. But it was just gorse land in those days. It was just a common land, really, where you see things like heather growing and so on. So there was certainly no airfield or official landing strip or any facilities. But that was the first recorded use that I found of it being used for aviation.
Right, okay. Okay, and so I suppose it came to prominence in World War II, really, didn't it? Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, the army had actually taken back possession, you know, once again, if you like, in the very early part of war, 1939. They were using it as a training facility, but again, it was just open land in those days, and there had been a shooting range there in the 19th century. Traces of it, I believe, were still there right through World War II, in fact. But the Air Ministry decided in 1941 it would be a satellite airfield to RAF Aldermaston, which again was part of the nuclear age and a different guise completely. So Aldermaston was an airfield about 7 miles east of Greenham Common. But it was the Air Ministry decided it would be an operational training unit for RAF Bomber Command. They'd use it for training, air crew, to fly missions to Germany and so on. However, of course, Pearl Harbor happened at the end of 1941. And then thereafter, our American friends joined us in World War II. And the airfield was built between 1941 and 1942. And in fact, the first unit to move in was an American unit of C-47 Dakotas. And they were there in 1942 between September and November that year for Operation Torch. So they were just en route to North Africa as part of that. So they were the first official use of it. And of course, we weren't quite in any official sense. It was not an official sense of an American airfield at that time, because it was still the American presence in Britain was just a very early stage then. Thereafter, in 1943, the RAF did move in briefly, and they had some aircraft called the Airspeed Oxford. So it's a fairly small plane, and it was used for training bomber command units. And in particular, it was used specifically for night landings. So Bomber Command were having a lot of problems where aircrew were coming back from Germany, perhaps a little bit disorientated, possibly damaged, and you're flying back to an airfield somewhere like Lincolnshire or Norfolk, maybe, in the dark. And a lot of them were having quite a series of accidents were occurring there. So it was aimed to try and improve night landings. So it was used briefly in 1943 for that, and then later in 1943, it had very brief use by US Army Air Force P-51s and P-47s. I'm talking weeks here, so very briefly. But it wasn't until 1944 that that officially became a US Army Air Force base.
Right. At what time was the runway constructed then?
So the runways were built between 1940. won in 1942. So it right. had the typical A-shape S-shape airfield. So you had three runways. One was 4,800 feet, one was 3,300, and the longest was the east-west, which was about 6,000 feet.
Right, okay. And what sort of facilities were on the base during World War II?
So fairly, as was quite common in wartime airfields, I mean, they were fairly primitive and it was, you know, transient facilities. So there were a number of fairly small hangars built there. There were accommodation for, I think, about 4,000 personnel, but that wasn't just on the base. There were intended camps around the area, so they weren't actually under any kind of cover. There were some Nissen huts built for personnel, but nowhere near enough to accommodate the whole number of supporting personnel. There claimed to be a total of 50 loops and hard stands for aircraft. But that was, I mean, it was gradually expanded through 1943 and 44, so it could have that many. I mean, the whole of this area.
And at this time, Jonathan, sorry to interrupt you there. At this time, was the airbase starting to, was its presence starting to creep into the local communities?
Yes, I would say from 1944 onwards, it certainly was. I mean, from March of 1944, it officially became a US Army Air Force base. It became Station 486 under the 438th Troop Carrier Group. So in particular, it was a very pivotal airfield for the whole area. And of course, it didn't stand alone. There were a number of other US Army Air Force bases around. So Aldermaston was one. So Greenham Common was obviously one. Membury, Ramsbury, and RF Welford, which remains a US Air Force base to this day. And slightly further out north, there's an airfield called Hampstead Norreys, but that was actually remained an RAF airfield. The other ones I mentioned just now were all US Army Air Force ones. But
right, okay.
Newbury was a fairly was one of the central hub towns, I suppose, in those airfields. Newbury and Hungerford, I would say. Newbury was actually visited by Glenn Miller in 1944, July of 1944. He came to the Corn Exchange and played a concert. So
wow, okay.
Yeah, I mean, Newbury, just to give your listeners an idea, it's a fairly small town, even to this day. It's not by no means a big town. It's a fairly modest-sized market town. And, of course, in the 1940s, it would have been all the smaller, really.
Are there any stories of the Americans in particular? We read through the history books the impact of Americans on the local communities. Mm-hmm. Are there any particular stories of what they did and how they ingratiated themselves or otherwise in the local communities?
I can't tell you any specific stories as such that I know, but I know they did marry many local women. That was certainly something that happened quite a lot. But it wasn't just to give you a bigger picture, it wasn't just the Air Force that were here. Of course, the US Army was here in probably greater numbers than the Air Force were.
So right.
You had the 101st Airborne Division, Screaming Eagles of Band of Brothers fame. So they were camped all over this area, particularly in the area just outside Hungerford. Aldbourne in particular was one of the areas featured, which is a true story, by the way. It's not fictional. I know they did, a number of very kind acts for local people. They were very kind to local children. They put on parties, and particularly at Christmas time, they're very supportive of the local community as far as rations and supplies allowed them to be. There was a good relationship built up with the Americans on the whole. I mean, there were a few incidents that happened, unfortunately. On the whole, you know, the relationship was a fond one.
Right. Okay. And Greenham Common played a fundamental role in Overlord, didn't it?
Mm, mm, yeah. Yeah, it did, absolutely, and also in Operation Market Garden too.
Okay. So, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, indeed. So, just to give you a bit of a bigger picture. In fact, as things moved, there's another aviation side to this story completely, and that's that. Greenham Common was effectively two bases from 1943 and 1944 onwards. So it was Station 429 as well. And Station 429 was on the boundaries of Greenham Common, if you like. But I'm talking right on the boundaries and even in part of the base itself, because what that was the US Army built a glider, outdoor glider factory, and which was Station 429. So the invasion gliders that they built for Operation Market Garden and for Overlord were very heavily built at Greenham Common. So 4,000 of the Waco gliders, in RAF service, in our service, they were called Hadrians. Fairly small, like 13-man glider.
Yeah.
They were 4,000 of those were built at an outdoor factory on the site. So that's a very large number of the totals used in World War II.
Wow.
And they worked night and day. They worked in seven areas. And parts were shipped over in these big wooden crates. So you had the Ford Motor Company were making parts for those gliders, and as well as a couple of other suppliers. So they were built in sort of kit form, if you like, on an assembly process outside in the cold, in the open, in the wet. And those gliders were then shipped out to the airfields I mentioned earlier. So Membury, Ramsbury, Welford, Aldermaston, and further beyond into the West Country as well, some of those airfields. They were shipped out to those places. And ready for Overlord. And in fact, General Eisenhower and Winston Churchill made a visit to RAF Welford in March of 1944 to see a big parachute drop. So that was something that was happening. RAF Welford is about 8 miles northwest of Newbury, so not too far away.
Right.
Those gliders were shipped out to bases. Some of them were used in the run-up to D-Day to train crews because, you know, landing a glider with a jeep in the back or an artillery piece was an important skill to get right the first time, really.
Yeah.
So they did a little bit of training. But once the glider crashed, it meant that perhaps, you know, it couldn't necessarily fly again because they were effectively controlled crashes, really. By this time, I mean, like I said, Greenham Common was the 438th Troop Carrier Group headquarters, so it was responsible for 400 C-47 Dakotas across the south and southwest of England. So it was the centrepiece of the troop lifting capability for the US Army into Overlord. And General Eisenhower himself actually came to Greenham Common in the evening, in the night as the mission started. So he saw the first of the C-47s off from Greenham Common at 2300 hours on the 5th of June before they flew over. So 80 of the Dakotas left Greenham Common on the night before D-Day, ready for the mission. Some towed gliders, some did parachute drops. So 101st Airborne Division men were loaded up into the C-47s and parachuted behind enemy lines, as we saw on some of the films. And with Easy Company and in Band of Brothers, and some tow gliders. So it was a real hive of activity at that time.
It must have been absolutely fascinating to watch them all taking off in multiples.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, so 80 aircraft taking off, and also, of course, they returned as well. So some of them sadly may not have returned, or they may have been damaged or lost. So it was a case then of rotating back and then back and forth and back and forth as the ships did too from Portsmouth and other places. So it was a real hive of activity in 1944.
And through to the end of the war, did it, because as bases moved forward and more forward operating bases as we'd understand them now, how did the airfield finish up the Second World War?
Well, the units that were the US Army Air Force units at Greenham Common moved forward to France, like you just alluded to just now. And by the time we get to after Market Garden, another big airlift took place with 90 aircraft from Greenham Common to the Netherlands later in 1944. And thereafter, operations at Greenham Common began to draw down in 1945, and the US, the base was handed back to the RAF Transport Command in June of 1945. And thereafter, from June 1945 to June 1946, the RAF did entrance training courses. So they ran five of those, whereby, you know, there was no flying, by the way. It was just drill, and of course, the National Service was still very much part of life at that time. And so entrance to the RAF as they were coming in, it was used as a training camp for them. That ran for a year, and then after that, June 1946 onwards, the airfield was abandoned.
Right, okay. What, literally just left?
Yes.
Wow.
So, I mean, but let's face it, I mean, across the country, that wasn't at all unknown. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of airfields had been built and more so in East Anglia and the east of England than right. this part of the country. But so there we are, really. So what happened was some of the Nissen huts were taken over by local people who may have lost their homes in some shape or form. Although Newbury only got bombed once or twice in World War II, and the damage was fairly limited. So there may have been people that were just looking to move to somewhere more spacious, possibly. It was used, I know, for local children did use it for model aircraft flying. And I think, well, why not, really? Because you've got a 6,000-foot runway. and it must have been an interesting place to see what was left over. But otherwise, in the period from 1946 to 1951, it was one of hundreds and hundreds of abandoned airfields.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
But as we know, the world was a rapidly changing place after the Second World War, and the Cold War was picking up apace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. So as we come into 1950... if we go back a little bit before then, I mean, because the Berlin airlift was a real big scare for everybody, really. I mean, I think it showed that, you know, the Soviets were particularly hostile to our intentions, really. They were hostile to our foothold in Berlin, and were trying to squeeze us out, really. And Stalin was in power. Stalin was a very paranoid Soviet leader who saw the West as a terrible enemy and was determined to try and get one over on us, particularly in Germany at that time. So we were in a bit of a state of disarray. I mean, Western Europe, of course, had been badly dislocated by the effects of war. So many countries, less so Britain, of course, but certainly France, Belgium, the West Germans, and other countries, Italy, for example, were, I wouldn't say they were defenceless, but they were in a very bad way. They weren't particularly capable of defending themselves. So in 1950... Well, NATO was born, of course, in 1949, a collective defence agreement between Western European powers. And we, of course, had a very good relationship of working with the Americans in Britain in World War II, particularly our armed forces and our air forces in particular. And in 1950, there was what was called an ambassador's agreement, whereby the US government asked if they could have a series of airfields redeveloped for what were then called very heavy bombers. So, of course, by that time, we're beginning to come into the jet age. You've got some huge aircraft then in service, like the B-36 Peacemaker, things like the B-45 Tornado, the B-47 are just about to come into service. Yeah. So they needed longer runways, stronger runways. They needed different types of fuel than were used in World War II for piston-driven aircraft.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're into the nuclear age, so they needed special storage facilities for those things. And, of course, they were planning for the long term too, whereas World War II, the airfields developed and given to the Americans were very temporary facilities, quite primitive facilities. These airfields were very much more for the longer term. So Greenham Common was one of the four airfields allocated back to the, what was then the US Air Force, along with Bryce Norton, Fairford, and Upper Hayford. So they were very similar type of airfields. So what they did was, in 1951, a series of surveys were undertaken by the US Army, because the US Army actually built the runways for the Air Force. And it was to be developed for 2,000 personnel, 2,000 airmen. It was to have a 10,000-foot-long runway. And so in that period from 1951 to 1953, the US Army moved in. They demolished most of what was left from World War II because it was not fit for purpose thereafter. And they set about building this 10,000-foot runway, accommodation for 2,000 personnel, special storage area for the weapons, three hangars, and other facilities to make life higher quality experience and work than World War II as well, because people would be doing, say, 2, 3, 4 year tours there. So it needed to have more better facilities ready for airmen.
Right. Okay. Okay. And you mentioned the runway being extended, 10,000 foot runway. That's a pretty impressive runway for obviously for those new aircraft types.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it was. 10,000 feet even now would be a long runway, but in those days, yeah. Of course, was extremely long runway. But aircraft were quite, you know, if it was fully loaded with fuel and weapons and everything else, and it was like a B-36 Peacemaker, it would probably need most of that to get airborne.
Yeah.
And of course, aircraft have to take off and land into the wind, so it was just the east-west runway. I take it then was the direction the wind tended to blow in, and had an aircraft control tower built, which is still there today, one of the surviving bits of the old airfield.
Yeah, I want to come back and ask you a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. And so in 1954, the first unit of aircraft flew over from Arizona. So there was a group of 43 B-47 Stratojets, four-engine Boeing jet bomber flew over from Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And they were the first unit to arrive in March of 1954. But there was a problem, really. So they arrived in March of that year, and fairly quickly, the runway began to break up. I think it may be because there was some sort of underground springs deep under. Perhaps the US Army survey hadn't detected those. So obviously, aircraft can't fly and land and take off onto a runway that's breaking up, because we'd get foreign object damage and it would be catastrophic potentially. So they had to move off to RAF Airford for the rest of their stay. And the whole process effectively had to begin once again, really. So that two-year process, the US Army was shipped back over again from 1954 to 1956, even into 1957 a little bit, some of them. And they had to break up what they just spent all that time building, strengthen it, and they also extended it too. So they added 1,000 feet at either end. So it was then a 12,000-foot runway from 1956 onwards. And so the Air Force were able to move back. They did what were called reflex actions. So 90-day periods where B-47 units would fly over from the US, spend 90 days at Greenham Common, Upper Heyford, Bryce Norton, or other bases. So crews would understand the meteorological conditions for flying in Western Europe, you know, the sort of terrain they'd experience, and that kind of thing. And then they'd fly back to Arizona, Texas, wherever they come from. And again, something that then would happen, like tankers would then fly in. So the Boeing KC-97 tankers, which were a prop-driven aircraft to refuel the B-47s or B-52s even later that came thereafter and other bomber types. They'd spend 90 days, then they'd fly back to the US or North Africa or another US Air Force base outside the US. And it would rotate. So crews were then building up experience in England, you know, repeatedly over that period. So that's the kind of deployment we saw between 1954 and 1964. And there were some quite interesting visitors. So there was a deployment of B-36 Peacemakers in 1956 during the Hungarian uprising. Other aircraft that came through periodically were things like B-57s. There were a couple of B-58 Hustlers that came in occasionally. And then from 1960 to 1964, B-52s made quite frequent visits. Because and they're quite often coming on a Friday, spend the weekend in Europe. You know, crews could go up to London and that kind of thing, and then they'd fly back on a Monday. So it was a nice jolly bit.
Some amazing aircraft types there, though, John.
There are, really were. And there were a couple of other sort of more brief visits from other aircraft too. But they were the main ones. So the main ones that we saw, B-47s. KC-97s. There were three. The unit that ran the airfield actually had three Dakotas permanently on the books. They were used for things like transport duties of officers to other bases and liaison visits and that kind of thing. So they were a permanent part of the unit.
Wow. Okay. Now, at no time were any nuclear weapons based at the airfield then, were there?
Well, I think they. Well, I don't know that for certain, but I suspect very strongly that they were, because there was a special compound built for them in the far southwest corner of the base, which remains there today, in fact. So I'd be very surprised if there weren't weapons there, because, of course, you know, we're talking about the real high tension in the Cold War in this period, from 1954 to 64, you know, the Berlin crisis, the Suez crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, in 1962, yeah. which aircraft were kept at a very high level of readiness. And, of course, also, I should also say that packets of about 15 aircraft of B-47s I'm talking about were kept at what were called quick reaction alert status. So they would sit at one end of the runway, bombed up and fueled up, ready to go. So I assume that they wouldn't have done that without any weapons on board. So I'm fairly confident that special weapons were active, shall we say, at the time.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And how did the airfield then come to the end of its aircraft service life?
Well, by the time we get into the 1960s, the B-47s begin to look like quite a tired old aircraft. So it was subsonic. I mean, quite a capable platform, but by the time we get to the early 1960s, things like F-4 Phantoms were coming to service. The F-111 was in development. And of course, like I said, the B-58 Hustler and other much faster supersonic aircraft were beginning to be either enter service or would very soon be. And of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis showed that, you know, if you've got fixed bases like Greenham Common or Upper Heyford or RFF, they're vulnerable because an airfield doesn't move. So the US doctrine was shifting the nuclear force more towards submarines. So you had Polaris and Poseidon were entering service in the early 1960s. So they had a lot less vulnerability. And of course, after 1957, when Sputnik was launched, you know, theoretically, you know, those fixed sites were theoretically very vulnerable to Soviet missile strikes. So in 1963, 64, a lot of these bases that I mentioned, Upper Heyford, Fairford, Bryce Norton, Greenham Common, were sort of drawn down. I mean, Bryce Norton was, of course, handed to the RAF. Upper Heyford was still active, perhaps at a lower tempo, and RAF Fairford was also handed back. The B-47s, 1964, 1965, were scrapped, or most of them were, certainly. And so Rob McNamara, who was US Secretary of Defense at that time, announced that Greenham Common was one of the airfields that were closed. So July 1964, it's handed back to the Ministry of Defense. And there was, again, a brief period from 1964 to 1967 where it was put on what they call care and maintenance. So it was still an active airfield, theoretically, but it had no permanent units. So they cut the grass, they'd look after the buildings and make sure things were generally in a reasonably tidy state, but it wasn't an active airfield anymore.
Right, okay. So what changed that then?
Well, what changed that was what happened in France, really. So President Charles de Gaulle, in power at the time, decided that he was going to take France out of the military part of NATO. And so there were actually a series of very similar US Air Force bases in France at the time. There were about eight US Air Force airfields in France. And so those units needed to find a new home. So some of them were disbanded, some were moved to West Germany, and a couple of them were moved to Britain. So I think RAF Alconbury accommodated one of those units, and Greenham Common accommodated some, it became reactivated again. So in January of 1967, the US Air Force reactivated Greenham Common, and it was mainly used as a storage base at that time. So it was reactivated with a very small number of personnel. I'm talking probably sort of less than 100 airmen. They moved in, and some of the equipment that was moved out of France was moved to Greenham Common. So you had these three huge hangars there. So I'm talking about anything from typewriters and desks, blankets, beds, furniture was loaded up into the hangars from France to be disposed of or shipped back to the US or sold off. So that period didn't last too long. But the US never handed it back from then until 1992. So it was thereafter permanently a US Air Force base. But in the period from 1967 to 1982, it was a very low tempo. It was effectively on tick over, really. So there was a very small US presence that would just open it and keep the base open for emergencies, really. So if there was to be any kind of conflict in West Germany, if there was to be a Soviet invasion or something terrible, it could be very quickly reactivated for, you know, F-4 Phantoms, B-52s, tankers, transit units that would be needed to reinforce the front in West Germany. So that was the theory and the idea of what would happen there. So that was the way things moved. And of course, you know, then you had the air tattoos move in the 70s as well.
Okay, yeah. So what we recognise now as the as RIA at Fairford, that was Greenham.
Yes, yeah, it was there for a 10-year period. So I mean, North Weald in Essex was the original home of the air tattoos as they were in 1971. But again, there was a bit of a it's an airfield to this day, of course. But I think the M11 motorway was built very quite close to the end of it. So if you're talking about having big aircraft, it wasn't so suitable. So I know Tim Prince and his friend Paul Bowen were looking for a new airfield. So if you look at it on a map, Greenham Common was perfect in many ways because it was right in the central south of England, where you've got the M4 motorway that's been built in 1972, train lines, you had the roads going from north to south, east to west, you know, you had railways going very close to the base. So, and a 10,000 foot or 12,000 foot runway. So not doing very much. So they banged on the base commander's officer's door and said, could we use Greenham Common as an airfield? And he welcomed them with open arms. So in 1973 onwards, it wasn't held every year, by the way, it became home to the Embassy Air Tattoo and then what became known as the International Air Tattoo at Greenham Common. So, I mean, up to 200 aircraft. I mean, like I said, although it wasn't a busy airfield most of the time, in the periods when the International Air Tattoo was on, you know, you could have 200 aircraft from as far afield as New Zealand and Australia.
Wow.
I mean, the types of aircraft that we dream of seeing now were common.
Yeah, I'd love to see them. To see them back here now. Yeah. So how much longer did it continue as an active airfield before we move into talking about its next role in life?
Well, between in the 70s and up until the early 80s, aircraft did occasionally land at Greenham Common. I mean, one thing that's worth flagging was the main air use, apart from the air tattoos themselves, were the US Army did a series of exercises called flintlock exercises, and that was to test readiness to move personnel, equipment and aircraft to Europe in the event of an emergency. So I think there were three of those exercises held at Greenham. There was one in 70, 71 and 76, and you'd have all sorts of things flying over, like mostly things like Hercules, occasional C-97s again, KC-135s, bigger transport aircraft, C-141,
yeah.
C-5s,
yeah.
And other aircraft, in fact, too. And they would move personnel, US Marines even, and people like that would come to the base for those periods and do a period of fairly intense training for a month or two.
Yeah.
And then they would fly back to the US and the exercise would be over until the next time.
And Jonathan, what were the local communities like at this time? Because the airfield was opening, it was closing. Was there any resistance then to it? Its continual use as a active airfield?
Well, yes, there was in the 70s because, like many towns in Britain, they grew post war. Of course, population grew. Houses were built, many more houses were built than were there in World War II or the 1950s. So Newbury and Thatcham, which is the adjoining town, are, like I said, two fairly small towns. But I think the Achilles heel for Greenham Common was that it was very close to those two towns. So it's only, I mean, you could walk from the north gate of Greenham Common into Newbury in about 15 minutes, probably. It's not very far at all. And the town of Thatcham, which was originally a village in the 1950s, grew to be a town, and it's now a town of about 28,000 people. It wasn't quite so big in the 70s, of course, but still many post-war homes have been built there. So things got a little bit tense. Well, maybe not tense is the right word, but in 1976, a whole batch of F-111 bombers from RAF Upper Heyford moved down to Greenham in 1976, while the runway was being resurfaced at Upper Heyford. And the F-111 was a very powerful supersonic aircraft with two very powerful jet engines. And for people like you and me that love aircraft, that was great. But for people that didn't, you know, I think you get the picture. So, you know, having those, you know, up to 40 F-111s in a fair, quite close to two towns, didn't go down very well with some people because of the noise and so on. So there was a bit of a bit of uneasiness there, and then in 1977, the US government was talking about basing KC-135 tanker aircraft at Greenham Common. And that rumbled on for about a year or so. And there was a bit of a protest locally about that because people didn't want, you know, more jet aircraft coming to Greenham Common, et cetera, et cetera, in such a built-up area. But in 1978, they decided not to, but possibly not because of the protest. But if you look at Greenham Common on a map, it's very close to AWE Aldermaston, and Atomic Weapons Establishment at Aldermaston.
Yes.
So it's got very highly restricted airspace, even for military flights. You're not allowed to fly over it, full stop. So it was very unforgiving for air crew. So it means that you can't really circle Greenham Common. You have to really go straight in. So you can imagine uncertain weather conditions. That's quite risky. It's foggy and that kind of thing. So air crews, it posed a bit of a challenge to especially bigger aircraft like those tankers. So it was decided not to send them to Greenham. They moved to RAF Fairford instead. And similarly, about very shortly afterwards, the US Air Force were talking about moving in TR-1s, which were now known as U-2 aircraft, into Greenham Common. But that was scrapped. Again, they moved to RAF Alconbury. So that's the way things are, really. So the population had grown quite a lot in the area post-war, and people didn't want jet aircraft to become part of the community again, really.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programmes taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
So it sort of wound down again, didn't it?
Briefly, yeah.
And the world then took on another sort of change of focus. And we entered, I suppose, the sort of third and final major stage of RAF Greenham Common's life with the introduction of cruise missiles.
Yeah, that's right. So in January of 1979, NATO decided to send cruise missiles to Western Europe, to 5 countries in Western Europe, of which, you know, we were one of them, Britain. And in fact, we had the largest number of cruise missiles. I think it was due to be 512 deployed, and we took 160. In fact, not all of them were sent to England in the end because of the way the Cold War developed and ended ultimately. But Greenham Common was announced in June of 1980 as to be one of the 2 bases that would accommodate cruise missiles, along with RAF Molesworth in Cambridgeshire. And it's interesting, really, because, and a sort of irony, really, that they decided to choose Greenham Common. One of the reasons was that most of the time there wouldn't be very many aircraft movements because aircraft would come and go occasionally, take and deliver missiles and equipment and that sort of thing. But there'd be no permanent aircraft based at Greenham Common in the period. So in 1982, the 501st Tactical Missile Wing, which was the parent unit at Greenham Common to accommodate missiles, was activated. And the first cruise missiles came to arrive in November of 1983. And ultimately, so you've gone from a period of being what you call a standby base to being a sort of permanently worked up major base, really, from 1982 onwards, where ultimately over 2,000 airmen would arrive at Greenham Common. So you're building up to the sort of levels it hadn't seen since the early 1960s when Strategic Air Command were at the base. And of course, they also had to build a series of facilities at the base. They had to build the special compound that the cruise missiles would be kept in. They built new accommodation for airmen. They built a high school, ultimately. And they built a command headquarters as well, which is still there to this day. All of which took a couple of years to build. Quite an intense period. This is when the protests start to kick off, really, because people began to get twitchy that
we went to
a new phase of the Cold War, and missiles and numbers of missiles and warheads and so on were increasing, and on both sides. And, you know, If you're old enough to remember the early 1980s, it was a particularly tense time in terms of the Cold War.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah,
I do remember this this well, particularly on the news with the protesters arriving and the camps and that sort of thing. I didn't quite understand its wider context, I think, at the time, which was, you know, why they were coming here and that sort of thing. But yeah, so I sort of only saw what was on the news.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. I think, you know, I was a lot younger at the time. I didn't fully appreciate the whole picture either, really. But the protests weren't unique to Britain. Of course, there was a big, very, very much bigger protest in many ways in West Germany and other countries. So in this period between 1982-83, activity was increasing at the base. So more and more aircraft, C5 Galaxies delivered the missiles and C-141s delivered the warheads. And again, there'd be occasional visits from other aircraft too. So you might see things like some VIP C-135s and things like that occasionally came into Greenham Common.
Right, okay.
So senior officers were inspecting and looking at what was going on and so on.
Yeah.
And there was even, bizarrely, I didn't know this until quite recently, Caspar Weinberg, one of President Reagan's ministers, if you like, actually came to Greenham Common to the final international air tattoo in 1983, which I find quite staggering, really.
It's
true. It's true. It did happen.
That activity around the base, Jonathan, both local and, of course, we saw it nationally on in the press and on TV and things. But there was also, it's now been established, Soviet spy activity as well.
Yeah, I think, this is something the government get very twitchy about, really, and I can understand why. But have you ever seen a television series called The Americans? You'll know that there are, there were Soviet and now, of course, Russian. People actually can live under very deep cover in this country and other countries who were born behind in Russia or the Iron Curtain, the Soviet Union as it was then. And assume fake identities as a British person or a West German person. They were to be, you know, to gather intelligence and establish networks. And in time of war, they were there to cause mayhem. Jane's Defence Weekly broke a story in 1986. What evidence this was on, it's probably still argued to this day that they did have, you know, agents very close to Greenham Common, possibly even in the peace camps themselves. I spoke to an MOD policeman once about this, and he was very guarded about the topic. And he said, his words to me were they had operatives or something, he said to me. And bizarrely, some people were found with East German radios, apparently. But beyond that, I've no further details, really. I don't know any more.
Yeah.
Really. But I would be amazed if they didn't have personnel in the community in Newbury and Thatcham and other areas watching what was going on, gathering intelligence, and ready to cause mayhem if it was ordered. There were countermeasures set up by the Ministry of Defence to deal with that.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure our government knew what was going on. It's official, really. I mean, part of Cold War history, and even to this day, I mean, it's thought there's up to 500 Russian agents undercover in this country in a similar way than was almost certainly the case back then. So
that's another podcast.
It is,
own, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Let me just go back and I suppose put a little bit of context around why I asked that question, and that was because the missiles that were based at Greenham were mobile launch missiles.
Hmm.
So they wouldn't necessarily be launching from the base.
No.
They would be leaving the base to launch from somewhere else, weren't they?
That's right. So just to give you a bit of a technical background, really. So, I mean, if cruise missiles now, everyone's seen them, you know, launched against Saddam Hussein and other places. Launched against Osama bin Laden originally, but they didn't get him, unfortunately. But so a cruise missile is actually guided by satellites. So it was developed in the 1970s by General Dynamics, I think it was. And they're extremely accurate. So they fly at subsonic speed under radars And they had a range of about 1,600 miles if launched from Britain, or anywhere. In fact, that was their range. So they could just about hit the edge of Moscow if they were launched from Britain. That's right. So, I mean, in theory, they could have launched the cruise missiles from the compound on base, and there was a quick reaction alert flight of 16 missiles at Greenham Common kept on permanent readiness. So they could have launched, you know, at a moment's notice if they needed to. But the idea in the build up to war, you know, with the Warsaw Pact, they would deploy to a camp somewhere up to 100 miles from Greenham Common. They would camouflage themselves. They would dig themselves into defensive positions. You'd have the US Air Force Security Police and RAF regiment would probably go out with them too. They'd establish a camp somewhere, conceal themselves, and they'd await the order to fire. So that's right, really. So the idea was that they would scatter because Greenham Common was obviously a known location. But this other location, and the sites were pre-surveyed, by the way, so they've been pre-surveyed by the satellites, so the coordinates could be fed to the missiles, etc., etc. That was the idea, really, and I think that's where the Soviet moles and so on came in, really, because you know I think the idea was that they would intercept them and cause mayhem, follow them, and that kind of thing. If they probably tried to, but that was the thought. That was the thinking, really. So the cruise missile was intended to have less vulnerability than a fixed missile, if you like.
And by any chance, Jonathan, did you ever find out where any of these remote locations were?
No, I'm afraid not really. I mean, I've asked a few people. There's a few theoretical locations. One of them was Barton Stacey, just south of Winchester, which I think is probably quite a possibly accurate place because it's Ministry of Defence land or around there, and it's just south on the A34. If you follow the road out of the base, get on the A34 and head south, you would be there fairly quickly. There are woods around there, so you could conceal yourself fairly quickly and easily. So that would be quite a strong candidate. I mean, in terms of exercise, cruise missiles went out mostly to Salisbury Plain and a few other locations, but I find it unlikely they would launch there because those locations were obviously known. I mean, it could have been anywhere. And obviously, they wouldn't drive to those sites to exercise because it would be a bit of a giveaway. It could have been, theoretically, 100 miles would take you to East or West Sussex. It would take you to the New Forest and those sort of areas. Or possibly further north, it could take you to Gloucestershire. But actually, in terms of declassified locations, I'm afraid I don't know.
Oh, well, don't ask. But with the deployment of, shall we say, the Western missile arsenal, the pressure on the Soviet Union increased dramatically, and the potential for some sort of treaty came into play, didn't it?
Well, I think, it did. The main thing in the room, of course, was someone who we just lost, and that was Mikhail Gorbachev. Really. He came to power in 1985, determined to radically change things, not just in terms of internally, but also foreign policy too, really. So I think that was the real landmark, really, as far as the Cold War goes and cruise missiles go. And I should also say, when cruise missiles were deployed, NATO took what they call a double decision. So they decided to deploy cruise missiles in Pershing II in West Germany, but they also decided to negotiate with the Soviets to withdraw their intermediate nuclear forces, which they've been building up since 1977. So the negotiations with the Soviet Union have been sort of ongoing, but they'd not been very successful, really, up till Gorbachev's time. And then in Gorbachev, like Mrs. Thatcher said, there was someone they could do business with, really. So they reopened negotiations on intermediate nuclear forces, of which cruise missiles were one of the major components. And so in December 1980, an agreement was signed. The INF Treaty, Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, was signed between Gorbachev and Reagan. And it was a real breakthrough and a real radical step in terms of arms control and in fact, disarmament, really, because it would outlaw a whole class of nuclear weapons, which had never been done before. So it meant that in the 3 years after, between 1988 and 1991, cruise missiles would be withdrawn from Greenham Common and the other four NATO countries, so Germany, Italy, Belgium and the Netherlands. Pershing 2 missiles would be withdrawn from West Germany, and there would be a series of inspection visits to the bases that they were accommodated at, of course, which Green Common was one of them.
Now, therein lies a story, isn't it? The inspection visits. You got a fabulous photograph of Tupolev 154 at Greenham Common.
Yeah, that's right. So in July 1988, the very first Soviet intermediate nuclear forces inspection visit happened at Greenham Common. They had to give 16 hours prior notice of them coming, and they were there to inspect facilities. They couldn't inspect the missiles, but they could inspect facilities. They could ask the Americans to take photographs. They couldn't take those particular photographs of missiles themselves. And there were a whole series of these, about 6 months apart normally, where Soviet inspection teams could spend 24 hours in Britain. Some of them would go up to RAF Molesworth. Others of them would stay at Greenham Common. They had to be accommodated overnight, and they'd fly out then the next day. And in that time, you would see Ilyushin 62s, Tupolev 154s. I think there was another type of older Soviet aircraft. And they were Aeroflot branded aircraft. So they weren't ostensibly Soviet military aircraft. But they flew in and they flew out. Yeah, so it was quite something to drive along up the road to joining Greenham Common to see a Soviet airliner parked up at a US Air Force base. It really was a sign of the times, really, that things were changing.
And that was the beginning of the end, wasn't it, for the airfield?
Yeah absolutely. So by the time we get to July 1989 was the very first withdrawal of cruise missile flight. So the first 16 missiles were then shipped back to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Arizona. And at periods thereafter, so there were 6 flights of cruise missiles at Greenham Common. There were 96 missiles in total. So they began to draw down from July of 1989. And then by the time we get to March 1991, the very last flight of cruise missiles is flown back to the US. And the 501st Tactical Missile Wing still lingers on for a few more months, and then it's disbanded in June of 1991. And the idea then was to keep Greenham Common, again, was for it to revert to a standby base at first. But it was becoming quite clear that in the spirit of the disarmament and the end of the Cold War, what was becoming the end of the Cold War, that ultimately the base would close. So in November of 1991, it was announced that the following year the base would actually be vacated by the US Air Force, and it would be handed back to an uncertain future to the Ministry of Defence.
So what's left of the airfield and the buildings, and is the runway still there?
Okay, so what happened was the base finally closed. The US Air Force left in September of 1992, and for a brief period, the Ministry of Defence held the land, and there were sort of various questions over what might be done with it, because, of course, our own forces were drawing down in Europe as well. So the RAF was looking at withdrawing from West Germany, or Germany as it was then. And there was talk about, you know, what do we do? Do we store, you know, do tornadoes go to Greenham Common or what? And in the end, various ideas were kicked around, because a number of airfields were withdrawn. Of course, the US Air Force had pulled out of other bases across Europe too. So the Ministry of Defence in 1993 said this is you know, no longer needed. So what happened was it was ultimately given back to West Berkshire. So what came to be West Berkshire Council in the later 1990s, they took ownership of the site, and what became New Greenham Park, a business site, took over the old technical side of the airfield. So that's where the library and the bank and the facilities at the Air Force had the cinema. Some of the accommodation area was taken over as a business park I think it was about 1997 they took that on. They kept a number of the buildings were there for many years that the airfield had, including some of the barrack blocks were there. They were there until the late 90s. But gradually the business park demolished one by one. Most of the old buildings are now gone. The old base chapel still stands. The runway itself was broken up and provided very valuable concrete and aggregate for road building and other house building schemes. So effectively, it was like a quarry, really. So, I mean, there was a 12,000-foot runway, which goes down about 4 feet deep. So the volume of concrete and rubble they were able to reuse was actually quite valuable as a resource in itself. So between, I think it was 1995, 96, 97, that was broken up entirely, which took obviously quite a long time. Some of it was used for the, again, controversial Newbury bypass being built at that time. And others was just sold off to other commercial uses, really, for building projects and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there is one very small centre, the centre section of the runway is still there, but that's the only part of the runway that still remains. The cruise missile complex, or the ground launch cruise missile alert and maintenance area, the Gamma site, that's still there, pretty much fairly intact. There's some things that have been taken away. Some of the barbed wire has been taken away, and some of the extremely advanced sensors for the time, they've been stripped out. There was a watchtower there, that's gone, but the old nuclear weapons storage facility from the 1950s is still there as part of the Gamma complex. And the control tower's left, of course. So
tell us about the control tower just before we wrap up, Johnson.
Yeah, sure.
That's still there, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. So the control tower was, like a lot of the buildings, was empty and abandoned for years and years and years, and it was beginning to decay. You know, the windows had gone and it was just a shell, really. And Greenham Common Parish Council bought the building, the remains, with the intention to restore it to like a community centre, a community space. So that's a whole other story in itself. We could talk quite a long time about that process.
But you can visit it, can't you?
Yeah, you can visit it. So in 2018, it reopened. It was refitted as a cafe and a museum. So, yeah, Greenham Common Control Tower is now open from Wednesdays to Sundays, inclusive, for you, the public, visitors, to come and see. So you can have a coffee, you can have a sandwich, you can have lunch, you can go up to the very top of the observation room where the control tower's main operations were, and you can see over a wonderful, wonderful view over West Berkshire. That's alive and well, okay. And a very successful venture. One of the facilities that is still left as well is the base high school. That's now been repurposed as a hospital. So that's still there. One or two other small little things still remain here. And some of the old base accommodation houses outside the base, on the Newbury side of the base, still remain as well.
Oh, that's a shame. Now, I do have a lot of questions I still wanted to ask you, but time is pressing on us. So if you want to find out more, you can get a copy of Jonathan's book. Now, it's just been revised, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. So okay. In lockdown, I gave it a revision.
And we'll put links to where they can get that in the show notes.
Okay, thank you.
So final question, Jonathan. What do you think what's the lasting legacy of RAF Greenham Common?
I think it's having thought about this, there's two aspects, I would say. One is that it played its part in the downfall of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact by being one of the many cogs of Western defence, really. So it played its part in the ultimate defeat of communism, really, I think, in being part of that strong force posture of deterrence and the Anglo-American special relationship as well. And the other side, I would say, too, is that it has an ongoing human legacy as well, I would say, between the many, many, many airmen that came to Greenham Common, served here, and still have family ties to the West Berkshire area to this day. Yeah. Many airmen that came to Greenham Common said it was the best time in their life, and many of them married local women. Some of them still have family and grandchildren that are being born today here as a result of their time at Greenham. So there is an ongoing personal connection of friendship and family between West Berkshire and the Americans who were airmen at Greenham Common.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating stuff, Jonathan. I've learned so much today. Thank you so much for joining us. Before you go, can you just tell us where we can find you on social media?
Yes, that's fine. So my Twitter account is my handle on Twitter, and the Greenham Common account, where I publish details of things that have happened at Greenham Common and things that are happening at the control tower, is at Greenham_Common. So it's called, my name is Greenham Skies. That's how you can find me on Twitter.
Right, we'll put a link to that as well. It's a good account to follow, so do follow that. Jonathan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Jonathan.
Thank you.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.